From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Author and rock music historian Robert Greenfield is my guest. His latest book, A Day in the Life, One Family, The Beautiful People, and the End of the 60s, is a riveting and sad look at the culture of the 60s. Robert Greenfield, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Your book is almost like a novel, and I don't want to diminish the reader's experience by giving away too much. So, if you would, tell us what you think we should know about A Day in the Life.
Well, what I always say, which doesn't help anybody, is that I don't think I really know what this book is about, which is interesting, since I spent a year writing it. I did want it to read like a novel. The pull quote, the blurb on the back of the book, describes it as a rock and roll Tender as a Night, which is great if you've read Tender as a Night or you have any familiarity with F. Scott Fitzgerald. I don't deign to compare myself to Scott. I'm not on that level. But it is the story of two very extraordinary people who each come from a very extraordinary and very dysfunctional background. The heroine of the book, her name is Susan Ann Carolyn Coriat. She was called Puss from the time she was a child because, as her sisters say, she looked like the cat who had swallowed the cream. She was extraordinarily beautiful. She was a very wealthy heiress. And both of her sisters were proper ladies, as they say in England. Their father was the Viscount Curzon, who became the 6th Earl Howe, direct descendant of General William Howe and Admiral Richard Howe, who led the British forces in the Revolutionary War. They got beat, actually. They're still thinking about that in England. But her parentage is part of the book, who her real father was and who their real father was, her sisters. But she was raised in very highborn circumstances on an extraordinary estate in Wiltshire in England. I guess the hero and the anti-hero of the book is Tommy Weber, W-E-B-E-R, which in England was pronounced Weber. Tommy was born on an extraordinary estate as well in Denmark, had an incredible background. His father was a soldier of fortune. His mother was English. Tommy was brought to England at a very young age, separated from his older brother under extraordinarily dramatic circumstances. Both Tommy and Puss were physically very, very beautiful people. He was someone who loved to go fast. I guess that's the way I could describe Tommy. He was a race car driver. He was a seller of properties that did not exist. He was a gambler. He was a ladies' man. And the two of them met and fell in love. And Puss was 18 years old. She got pregnant. She had to go to court in order to be able to get her money, which was due her upon marriage when she was 21. And it was that sum of money that enabled them to become the beautiful couple in London. They lived in the most extraordinary flat. Puss had two sons in rapid succession. The older son is Jake Weber, who some people might know from the television series Medium. Jake plays Joe Dubois, Patricia Arquette's husband. His younger brother's name is Charlie. And what is the perfect storybook marriage with the perfect beautiful children rapidly becomes something else again.
Well, before we get into all the specifics of the story, I want to talk about the 60s. I mean, you in your book, you know, your subtitle is about the end of the 60s. But, you know, I mean, obviously the 60s ended, you know, in 1970. But the 60s are different than that because they sort of started in 1964 and they ended sometime later, maybe on December 8th, 1980.
75, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about the 60s. Why do you suppose the 60s is such an intense period of time, politically, musically, socially?
Well, there are so many different 60s. See, that's what's interesting. Everybody has their own 60s. And the 60s that this book is about is the swinging London 60s. And that's the London of the Beatles and Mary Quant and Carnaby Street And it's an extraordinary cultural explosion. There's no Vietnam War protests going on in England. There's not a feminist movement. There's not a civil rights component. It's basically a change in sensibility. And the upper class, for the first time in the history of English society, freaks out. Is that the best way I could put it? And all of a sudden, it's hip to be working class. And all of a sudden, society is turning itself upside down. And Puss, who is much younger than Tommy, and still wanting to become something more than a wife and a mother, gets into what was known as the King's Road scene. The King's Road ran, still runs, it hasn't stopped. It runs right through the heart of Chelsea. It is the main drag. And the King's Road scene was unto itself, and very much about style and fashion and sensibility. And Puss immediately plunges into the world of LSD, fashion. She tries to become a model. She tries to become an actress. She gets involved with all the major musical counterculture figures who are in the scene at that time. And this is actually the beginning of the separation between Tommy and Puss. And what's, you know, because it is real, this book, and it all did happen, what's strange and bizarre about it is that Tommy, who has never really gotten what's going on here, he's been raised very upper class. He's gone to a very good public school and been bred to become a leader of industry, a businessman, or actually what he wanted to become was a Royal Air Force jet pilot, but he was colorblind and so could not fly jets. He's the one who winds up hanging out with the Rolling Stones.
Right. Now, you kind of just rolled past LSD there for a second, and I want to just focus on that for just a moment.
Sure.
In the book, you talk a little bit about drugs and class. Of course, in England, they at least were much more concerned with class than we are here, although, I don't know, it's debatable, I guess.
Yes,
but
it is.
But you also say that certain drugs were high-class drugs and other drugs are low-class drugs. That is, marijuana and LSD were acceptable upper-class drugs?
Well, I don't think I ever classified them as high class and low class. Drugs are drugs. But what I did say is, at that point in time in England, it was only the upper class who had time and money and the ability to take LSD on a constant level. You get this intermingling between the very highborn who are hanging out with Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones and Anita Pallenberg and Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. All these young titled nobles are attracted to them because they're the reigning stars of the day. And in England, the taking of LSD was very much top-down. In America, because of Timothy Leary, another book I seem to have written, it exploded and it permeated the culture in every direction, from the bottom, from the top, from the sides. It was, you know, Life magazine, it was everywhere at once. Not so in England. In England, in 65, 66, going into the flower power summer, which they had over there as well, it was restricted to the elite. And what was interesting about these people is that they had been educated, they had hundreds of years of breeding, and when they took acid together, it was a different experience than when it became the drug of choice on the street in America.
Cynthia Lennon was on the show here, and she says she doesn't blame, you know, Yoko Ono for the dissolution of her marriage. She blames LSD.
Well, Cynthia would know. I mean, I don't blame Yoko for the dissolution of her marriage.
Yeah.
The Beatles are a different story, but what she's talking about is John Lennon became so obsessed with taking LSD, according to the way that Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, and Ralph Metzner described the way that LSD should be taken in their version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that he tried to kill his ego, and when he didn't have the trips that he thought he should have, you know, he was very upset. It's interesting. The English were trying to follow a guidebook or a manual to the LSD experience, which, of course, is not controllable and is so variable and has to do with, as Leary said, set and setting. But when you get people taking acid in thousand-year-old mansions who are wearing extraordinary clothes, and they look like they've come from the Middle Ages, I think that's significantly different than what happened in the Haight-Ashbury.
Well, when Puss started to take acid, was it illegal then?
In England, no.
Right.
So no. I mean, the acid is brought to England by someone whom Leary sent, because Leary wanted to bring the gospel of Leary to England, and he begins disseminating it, and you have, as I said, all the movers and shakers of London Rock Society, Paul McCartney, Jane Asher, Marianne Faithfull, Keith, Brian, Mick, they're the people who take it first. They're way ahead of the rest of the culture in terms of what they're experiencing.
Let's just talk about LSD for another second. It seems like, you know, some of the drugs that came into wide usage in the 1960s, particularly marijuana and heroin, are still in wide use, but you don't hear much about LSD anymore. Is it all gone? And
well, it's funny how whenever I do a reading in Santa Cruz or I talk to someone in Santa Cruz, they seem to talk about acid a lot. It must be just some kind of a coincidence.
You may be.
It's just the way it is. But as a matter of fact, in that period in England, heroin was legal. And you registered and you were a registered addict. The division between those who were having a psychedelic experience and those who were using heroin, there was a huge gulf at that point in time. LSD is now, I mean, Timothy Leary did a lot of damage in terms of his public figure and his espousal of LSD to the use of LSD as a therapeutic drug. It's now beginning to be used again because Humphrey Osmond, who coined the term psychedelic, originally was using LSD to treat alcoholics. And LSD has not vanished in terms of its newfound therapeutic uses. They're just beginning again. You know, whether it's a drug that is being used on the street, I really don't know.
Now, so Cynthia says that it drove this wedge between her and her husband, but with Tommy and Puss, it was much, I don't know, I mean, how does it lend itself to parenting?
Well, it's the drug you take if you want to be a good father and mother. It's just what it says. LSD will help you deal with a two-year-old who won't go to sleep. You know, you'll understand the two-year-old in ways you never have. You know what's interesting, and it really is a good question, is that what I find astonishing about these people, and it's a constant theme that runs through the book, Puss is basically losing her mind, and Tommy is someone who you never think would have been a good father. But the love that they have for their children and the way they attempt to take care of their children in an incredibly dysfunctional environment, and, you know, Tommy winds up at Villa Nelcutt, where Keith Richards is living, and the Stones are about to start recording Exile on Main Street, and his 8-year-old son Jake and his 6-year-old son Charlie are hanging out with the Stones, and they're really hanging out with them. But the fact that what the book is, one of the things the book is about, is, you know, we have gotten so mad about parenting now and doing the right thing for your children and taking care of them. What's astonishing about these two boys is how they survive and actually how they then take care of their father until he dies.
Well, hanging out with the Rolling Stones, we're talking with Robert Greenfield, and his new book is called A Day in the Life. Hanging out with the Rolling Stones, gee, you know, most people would think, gosh, what a great thing, hanging out with the Rolling Stones. It doesn't, in your book, it doesn't sound so great. I mean, what will people do to be included in the world of the Rolling Stones? Apparently anything.
Well, absolutely anything. I mean, you know, I hung out with the Rolling Stones, and it was great because I was there working for Rolling Stone magazine, and I was interviewing Keith Richards, and then I, you know, wrote about their American tour and wrote a book about that, STP, Journey Through America with the Rolling Stones, and you know, I was with them in L.A. when they were mixing the album, and I was there for a reason. If you were there just to be with the Stones, and you thought you were one of the Stones, you were probably going to wind up dead or find yourself by the side of the road as the Rolling Stones moved on, because only Mick and Keith can be Mick and Keith.
They're not very nice people.
I don't agree with that. I have a great affection for Keith Richards.
Mm-hmm.
I find him to be one of the great people in rock and roll. You know, someone who in his own way is extraordinarily brilliant and self-created and funny as hell. I have great respect for Mick Jagger, you know, as a songwriter and a businessman and an artist and a producer and a performer. The word nice doesn't apply to people in that world.
Well, at the same time, you know, a friend of Keith's who comes to Mick's wedding, Eric Clapton, mm-hmm. is in trouble and needs help, and Keith basically says, forget about it.
Well, Eric is addicted to heroin at that point, and he runs out of heroin, and he's going through withdrawal. He's so sick he can't get on the plane, and Tommy goes to score heroin to take care of Clapton, and Keith says, you know, man, he should have known. He shouldn't have come here if he was going to go through this. It sounds really harsh, but I guess it's someone who's been through it himself, Keith. You know, I guess it's one addict at that point talking about another.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what's in the book only makes sense in the context of the way the world was back then. It seems horrifying now. And, you know, the thing that most people jump on is that Tommy used his two young sons, 8 and 6, to smuggle what may have been as much as a kilo of cocaine to this house for Mick's wedding, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
He strapped it to their bodies, and they flew into the south of France, and Tommy was considered a great hero for having done this because they were living like outlaws, they were exiles, and anything that anyone did that flew in the face of authority was considered to be laudable.
But he was never paid back for the drugs.
Well, it doesn't make it any better. He was paid back in the sense that
he got to hang with the Keith
Richards. He became an honored guest at the house, and I'm giving the book away, but then why wouldn't I?
Right.
You know, when the news came that Puss had committed suicide, Keith told Tommy that he and the boys could stay there for as long as they liked. To me, that's the generosity of someone who does have a real heart.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think Keith does.
Well, good. Who talked to you when you were working on A Day in the Life, and who wouldn't talk to you, and will anyone ever talk to you again?
I hope not. I hope no one ever talks to me again. No. That's just me being facetious. I had the great I was very fortunate. I knew Jake and Charlie when they were kids, okay? I connected back with them while I was doing the book that came out before this one, which is called Exile on Main Street, Season in Hell with the Rolling Stones, which is the story of the recording of the album, what went on in Keith's house. And through Jake, I reconnected with Tommy, Tommy is also in the Leary book, because the world was smaller then, and everybody seems to have been traveling in the same circle. I hadn't spoke to Tommy in, almost 35 years, and everyone that I asked about him assumed that he was dead, based on the way he had been living then. So I interviewed Tommy for that book, and then he died suddenly, which was when this book began. I realized that there was a book here, and I had no idea how much of a book there was. So I interviewed Jake and Charlie. I interviewed Tommy. Jake had gone out to make a documentary about his mother and had shot video, a lot of video, with his father and with many of the people who had been close to Puss and Tommy back in the day. I then re-interviewed many of them. I spoke to Puss's sisters. I went to England and went to see where they had lived, went to the public school that Tommy had attended, went to the estate where Puss had grown up, went to rugby where Tommy spent the last years of his life. You know, if the book reads like a novel, and I hope in places it does, it's because I wanted to really create the way it was, the way it looked and felt, and you know, obviously you can't go back to the 60s, but what's extraordinary about England is, unlike America, they don't knock things down. So, you know, after having done 40, 50, 60 interviews, when you physically see the places that everybody's been talking about, it's kind of an extraordinary experience. You just you're there in your mind, and then you can write about it.
Well, I know the book has been very well received, but what about the boys who are in it and are still alive? Did they have they read it? What are they?
Thinking? Oh my God! Yeah, they no. Listen, this was done with their complete cooperation, and they both read the book long before it came out. They didn't take anything out. They wanted the real story told. In the end, the fact that they're both survived, they both have survived, and they are both functional human beings. And again, the fact that they took care of Tommy for longer or as long as he took care of them, I think speaks to the fact that, you know, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, but that doesn't mean that it's not a family. And I think the book is actually, here's a redefinition of what you think a family's about. Can you handle it, you know?
Yes. The drug smuggling or whatever. But let me come back to kind of where we started, which is about the end of the 60s. How is this story of this family, how does this story expand into the rest of the world and into your 60s and my 60s?
Well, you know what a lot of reviewers have said, because no one knows who Puss and Tommy were. And nobody would have ever known who they were had I not written this book. But in their own way, they are completely emblematic of what those times were like for some people. And just because they are highborn, and just because there was a lot of money there, none of that protected them from the cultural explosion. You know, Jake talks about it as a social revolution. And it took them both away. I mean, it really did cause their lives to explode in a manner that would not have happened at another time. I mean, the only analogy, I think, to me, a lot of the book, and now we go back to Scott and Zelda, we go back to Dick and Nicole Diver, who are the hero and heroine of Tender is the Night, there is a very 20s feel to a lot of this. History does repeat itself. The drug of choice in the 20s was alcohol. But the breaking down of sexual barriers and that was, of course, as a result of the disastrous consequences of World War I. You have a social structure which had existed until that point has been shattered, and people are trying to piece it together in their own way. It's exactly what happened to Puss and Tommy. It's exactly what happened to a lot of people, both in England and in America, during that period.
Well, Robert Greenfield, you seem to follow a certain as you go from one volume to the next in your canon of books that you've written, they sort of lead from one to the next. So, where has A Day in the Life led you? What's going to be next for you?
Well, they don't act. Well, you know, it's odd that they don't really follow one from the other logically. It's not like I'm thinking of what I'm going to do next. It's all just sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Seems to be my life's work.
It's a universal theme.
Yes, it is. We all understand those things. I'm actually now working on the authorized biography of Ahmet Erdogan, who was the extraordinary human being who founded Atlantic Records. Again, a very high-born person. His father was the first Turkish ambassador from the Turkish Republic to the United States. And Ahmet and his brother Nesui are, I think, among the most important figures in the creation of what has become popular music. They changed the face of America and the world through Atlantic Records. And Ahmet was an incredible character of major proportions, and that's what I'm working on now.
And he brought us Aretha Franklin and the Led Zeppelin. And
well, Jerry Wexler produced Aretha. Jerry Wexler was Ahmet's partner at Atlantic. He absolutely brought us Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, Bobby Darin, Ruth Brown, Ray Charles, Cream. The list is endless.
So when you say it's an authorized biography, does that mean you're constrained in some way?
No, I just like to say that because it makes me feel self-important. You know? What it means is I've been lucky enough to have been given the cooperation by Mika Erdogan, and because of that I got to go through 60 boxes of Ahmet's personal papers at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in New York, and have been able to speak to people, Keith Richards among them, mm-hmm. that I probably could never have reached if they hadn't known that she was okay with the book, but there are no constraints have been placed on me whatsoever.
So you don't have, I mean, having hung with the Rolling Stones as you did, you don't have Keith's cell phone, you can't text Mick or...
Well, no, I mean, you know, the funny thing, if anyone's interested, is that, you know, Keith called me. In other words, it was kind of like the White House. I kept, he's about to call, he's going to call, you have to be there, he won't leave a message, you know, he's calling, and then he called. But just to give you a sense of the scope of Amit's life, and again, this all sounds so self-serving, I've also been called by Kid Rock. So if you can put those two opposing ideas in your mind, if you can conceive of someone who actually began with Ruth Brown and Laverne Baker and then had the Rolling Stones and then at the end of his life was hanging out and very happy about it with Kid Rock, you get a sense of the scope of Amit's life and the size and the nature of this book.
And the scope and size of your own life, which is sounding more and more bizarre as we go.
My life is not bizarre.
I mean,
my life has always been writing about what I think I probably guess that I like more than anything else, which is, you know, rock and roll.
So let me ask you one question about the Rolling Stones. you've talked to them over the decades. Have they changed much?
It's a really good question. You know, what you learn when you really interview people and that people tell the same story, and they tell it over and over again because it's their story. It's the only one they can tell. I must say that having spoken to Keith recently, I can tell that he had become aware of his own grandeur and the size of his own legend. Having said that, he was hysterically funny on the phone 6 weeks ago, as he had been when I lived in his house for 2 weeks in 1971. So I don't think people basically change. I just think they become more of what they already were, if that makes any sense, especially when they have been so successful and so famous for so very long.
Well, the new book is called A Day in the Life, One Family, The Beautiful People, and the End of the 60s, and the author is Robert Greenfield. Thank you so much for talking with us today on From the Bookshelf.
It has been my great pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes or Facebook. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank rock music historian and author Robert Greenfield for being my guest this week on the show. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.